Hey everyone, this is Devendra here. I recently had a chance to chat with Prentice Penny. He is the co-showrunner on HBO's Insecure. He's also a producer and writer who's worked on shows like Brooklyn Nine-Nine and Scrubs. And he has a new documentary coming out on Hulu called Black Twitter, A People's History. It's premiering on May 9th. This is sort of an adaptation or continuation of Jason Parham's Wired article, A People's History of Black Twitter. And this documentary series, it's a three-part series that sort of tracks the movement. And it sort of tries to tell the history of Black Twitter and how influential it was for Twitter, for social media, and for culture as a whole. I thought this documentary was a lot of fun. It definitely reminded me of Twitter in its heyday, of when you would be tracking something, you know, pretty wild that was happening in the middle of the night. And because Twitter was such a great media platform, there were always people online who could follow it with you. There are also notable faces like Baratunde Thurston, Jay Wortham, W. Kamau Bell in this documentary talking about their experience on Black Twitter too. I think it's well worth watching out, and I hope we see more things like this that document life on social media. Because sure, Twitter may not be real, but you know, we have real feelings about it. Here's my chat with Prentice, and be sure to check out Black Twitter, the documentary on Hulu starting May 9th. Prentice Penny, thank you so much for joining us on the Engadget podcast.
I'm glad to be here. Thank you for having me.
I guess my first question for you, just having watched the first episode of this documentary, is how mad are you at Elon Musk right now? Just for ruining everything that made Twitter great, right? Because that's something I've been chewing on for a while.
I don't really give. It's so funny. It's, you know, when I started on to do the doc, he wasn't a part of it. You know what I mean? And so the article was written in 2021, which is when I came on board. So I felt the story was important and relevant, independent of any of that, right? And so to me, when I read Jason's article, he wrote it because he said, you know, so many things on the internet are here today, gone tomorrow, right? Like, you know, things like Vine or Friendster or MySpace and things like that, that he felt like it was the right amount of time to sort of document this, right? And so obviously I didn't know how prophetic that would be at the time. That it could be gone, and it's gone obviously in some form and fashion. But so I wasn't really thinking about it from
right.
He wasn't just a part of it yet.
Well, I'm just thinking right now, like you have this thing coming out, like, which is really looking at, like, I think Twitter at its height and what it was culturally, like how it could unite communities and kind of give everybody a platform in a way. And I look at this and I'm personally a little mad at like what we've lost, because Twitter still exists now. It's called X, but it's not the same. There are more bots. There's the community is not quite there. And I just feel dirty using it now, too. So that's me. Okay. So can you give us a sense? Can you help define what Black Twitter is and what made it so special compared to a lot of other Twitter communities?
I mean, I guess the way I would define Black Twitter is a space where Black culture specifically was hanging out in a digital way. And even though it was a public space, clearly it's Twitter, anybody can get on it, it still felt like you were having conversations with your friends or like on the back of the bus or like on the stoop or in the lunchroom. I mean, that's the energy of it. And I think what was so special about it, at least in the beginning space, which I think is like any space that, like, when you're in the back of the bus or in the lunchroom, mm-hmm. there's no hierarchy. It's not just because you're a celebrity, you are like immune to the jokes. Like, you're going to get it too, right? Which is, I think, how Black culture does. It's like, we're going to play the dozens, we're going to get jokes off and for everybody. So it sort of felt like a space where, again, there's not that many spaces, I think, in America and even in culture where, you know, money or class doesn't matter. This was kind of a equalization of a lot of things, that somebody in Kentucky who nobody knows could have a strong opinion as someone who you revere, right? And I think that's what made the space so fresh, because we don't really have spaces that are kind of make a level playing ground in this country. And that's what I feel like Black Twitter does, was kind of create like a level playing ground for anyone that has something important to say, could say it and it could be heard.
I think for me personally, like, as I think about Twitter as an anthropological thing, like something where people could just come together and talk, right? Like, what was interesting is that it definitely flattened that line between celebrity and normal person. Like, you could tweet a celebrity and they will see you pretty easily. And sometimes they may even respond, Was that part of what made Twitter unique, you think, compared to a lot of the earlier social networks that you talk about in the documentary?
I think so. I think that made it certainly more communal in a way, like differently than I think Facebook and some of the other spaces that were there. And I think the brevity of the platform, right? Which is like sometimes you get on Facebook and, you know, it's like your aunt's got 8 paragraphs to comment about, you know, what happened at the grocery store that day.
But
with, you know, Twitter, it was 140 characters. That was it. And obviously later you could add video and GIFs and memes, which just even truncated like the language in an even punchier, quicker way that you could have a whole conversation just in GIFs and everybody knows what you're saying, right? So I think the brevity of that, I think almost with the way that Twitter, we talk about this in the doc, you know, each of the creators had a different idea of what Twitter should be. Some thought it should be a town square. Some people thought it should be a news information thing. Some people thought it should be a blogging thing. And I think like with Black culture, the one thing that I think that we do really well is because we're often given the scraps of things, we have to repurpose something like, you know, taking the worst of the pig and making soul food, or taking the worst of this and making something that's unique to our culture, that I think we are really good at taking things that are could kind of be different things and make it be pliable for us. And I think that that's what the culture got to do, was because Twitter was a bunch of different things, we could use it a bunch of different ways. And I think that's what also made the platform so unique, was that it was so pliable, which I think is so different, because if you look at Instagram or Facebook, it's like, clear what those things are. You know what I mean? TikTok, it's very clear what TikTok is. And I think, you know, Twitter, it was a lot of different things. And I think because of that, it allowed it to have, again, much more pliability to it.
Gotcha. I think that was a point that Meredith Clark made in the documentary. And it's so, it just feels very, very fitting, because like, even you're saying even the creators didn't have a clear idea of what Twitter was. Like, Twitter was an offshoot of a podcasting company, you know, that nobody even remembers now. But Twitter was the thing that ended up surviving. That is just fascinating to me. It reminds me too of Vine, which was a thing that Twitter had created, and which also saw a lot of support from the Black community and also creators of color of all sorts, right? Like, that was a thing where people were doing interesting comedy and interesting skits because of the limitations of that video format, and then unfortunately also died.
I think, you know, obviously there's something that happens, I think, too, in this country, where it's like, you know, sometimes, you know, like money and finance and class is a barrier to do things creatively. Certainly, you know, pre-digital stuff in film, right? You have to, like, if you're making a film, you have to like buy the film, process the film, get the film transferred. I mean, it's so expensive. Whereas now you can do all that stuff on your phone, and the barrier to be creative, the barrier to do that, it just takes money out of it. If you're taking money out of it, right? Now you're just saying, oh, create, you know, creatively, what can I come up with? Right. And I think, again, like just taking money out of the equation and just kind of makes things a lot more accessible, obviously, for a lot of people.
Were you ever a part of like the older social networks, too? Because you guys mentioned a couple of things. I think trying to find the names of these, Black Planet, Black Voices.
I was on Net Noir, but I was on like Black Planet for a little bit. And then I don't think it lasted long when I was on Black Planet, because I think in that day I was still trying to figure out, like, what is this? You know, it was like you're dialing up AOL. You're like, what is this space that I'm on? Like, chat room. I'm chatting with someone in like another state, another city. Like, all of it was such a different concept from where we were, that I was like, I don't know what this is. And so a lot of the Black Planet stuff, I remember it, and I remember going to it, and I just remember being like, oh no, I don't know what this is. And it really, I think Facebook was one of the first ones, and MySpace too, but Facebook, I remember in like 06, 07, I was like, what is it? Oh, okay. Then I feel like my journey started then.
Yeah, somebody had mentioned that Facebook really feels like a gated community compared to what Twitter ended up being, because Facebook was initially tied to schools. It was initially, you know, it was for people who were in colleges, and also like the select schools that it was deployed to initially. But you guys made a good point in the documentary. It's like, I kind of don't want to talk to those people, or I don't want to talk to the people I used to go to school with. I just kind of want to have fun online.
Yeah.
I think that is essentially like what you're capturing here by documenting Black Twitter, basically. Anything else you want to mention about, I guess, what Twitter and Black Twitter was like during its heyday for you? Because the documentary mentions a whole bunch of interesting things, right? The way you could use Twitter to just follow drama in real time. That was That was like a hilarious thing. It turned Scandal into appointment viewing and also really helped the ratings of Scandal. Let me know about some of your highlights of that era, but also, do you think that's still possible today with Twitter or any of the alternatives now?
I don't know if it's in the same way. I think that moment in time, because I think so much of that stuff now is kind of like baked into like what, like when companies do, like, right? So like live tweeting wasn't a thing when Scandal, I mean, live tweeting just came from people watching Scandal wanting to talk about it. That's literally, and then that became live tweeting, where now companies just go, oh, we're going to have a live tweet component. I mean, it's just like part of a corporate rollout, but that wasn't what it was. And so I think there's so many things of like, even thinking of things like Zola, right? Which was just somebody talking about their whole adventures, and it's a full ass movie now, right? I think there are things that kind of were organically being baked that wasn't like, oh, I'm trying to make this pop off. It's just, this is what's happening to me, and people get to participate in that, right? So it was almost like Zola to me was the spinoff of Scandal, because it was like a live tweet watch of someone who's on the platform, which is an evolution of, oh, I'm watching a television show, to now I'm watching someone on the platform experience something in real time. And it's real time of that. So I think, I don't know if those things will happen in the same way, because they were just so like, not even trying to happen then, right?
Yeah, it was very organic.
Very organic. So I don't know if like, I think you'll see maybe the organicness of another tech experience, but I don't think on X that you'll see the same version of what that was, because it was just so, again, you're watching Rihanna and Ciara go at it, like you're like just that level, and I think you see some of that still now with certain celebrities, but it feels like right now there's like the Rick Ross Drake stuff, and it's like, it's also like two old men beefing about rap, about whose house is bigger. So it just feels a little like not the same way that something felt then. You know what I mean? It was just special, I think.
I think one of the most fascinating aspects of the documentary and Jason Parham's original article is basically Black Twitter was a representation of like how Black people contribute to culture in America, right? Like it is, the cultural contribution is everywhere, but the Black audiences and the creators don't always see the benefit of that. Can you talk a bit more about that aspect of it?
Yeah, I think that's true of anything in American culture, right? Like typically Black culture, you know, again, we don't have that many spaces in the C-suites of certain things to drive where the country's going, but we certainly have culture that we drive, and accountability in which we drive culture, right? I was talking about this the other day. I was like, you know, I equate like the early days of the monetization of that on Black Twitter the same way that I equate like hip hop artists in the 80s, right? It's like they were the groundbreakers, but they're not reaping the financial benefits like guys like Drake or Wayne or these guys are today, just by proxy of where they came along in the cycle of that. So, you know, some have, you know, like I think about people like LL Cool J and Queen Latifah, who have sort of politicked their careers into different ways, to who were early, early artists in hip hop, but not everyone has that same outcome, right? And I think Black Twitter is a version of that too. There are people that did stuff that's never really going to get fully monetized in that way and reap the benefits of. But then I think about people like Issa, who was an early adopter of that, and like Quinta Brunson, who was an early adopter of that, that are, you know what I mean? And so I think that it's unfortunate that, you know, again, Black culture doesn't always get the fruits of it, even if we're driving it. But I think about ways in which, again, we talk about this in the doc, that like, the way, you know, things that we just now equate as like regular hashtags started so organically, like Black Girl Magic, right? And then in episodes two and stuff, we get into sort of Black Lives Matter and things like that, that sort of evolve from that. I don't know if anything in the early stages of anything really fully reaps the real benefit of what it actually does.
I mean, that's a shame. Every time I hear these stories about people who are pioneers, basically just are kind of left out in almost like every technological and cultural shift. It's just unfortunate. You gathered some really great voices too in this documentary: Baratunde Thurston, Van Lathan, April Rain, of course, who basically created the Oscar So White campaign and hashtag and everything. Yeah. What was it like gathering these notables? You know, people who have spent a lot of time on Twitter and having them reflect back on it, because even if you knew like Elon Musk, you didn't know Elon Musk would be taking it over and changing it. But it did seem like post the pandemic, at least, like, we couldn't quite go back to what Twitter used to be just because the world had kind of broken a little, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it was really incredible. I mean, the great thing was Jason had such a foundation of people from the article. It was like, okay, cool. How do we build off of this? And really, it was in the early days, it was me sitting with Jason a lot and kind of picking his brain of like, okay, what did this person say? What was it they were saying at this time? And so just copious notes of like, because again, you're taking something that's like a 5-page article into like a 3, you know, 1-hour episodes, right? So you have to build them out in a different way. But it was incredible talking to them and talking to people who became memes, or talking about people who, again, like, you know, Black Girl Magic, like Keshawn Thompson and people like that who were like, just along the way, like Wesley Lowry, who was in Ferguson, and you're hearing like what it was really like on the ground in Ferguson, right? Like all of these sort of really sort of amazing stories and people that were in the forefront of it, you know, some who wanted to be in the forefront and some who did not expect to be, right? And everything in between. And I will say I was really humbled, especially because everybody's so young. You know what I mean? Like we don't, when we look back at like, you know, Black and white civil rights footage, we forget that like King was 39 when he was killed. Like he was doing a lot of stuff in his early 30s, right? And John Lewis, right? They're teenagers. But they don't feel that way to us because we look at it through black and through like all the footage is black and white. So they just feel old. But it's like, no, these were young. That, and so much change happens, I think, from like youth. And obviously seeing and then reflecting back on it, remembering, oh, this was 10 years ago for them. So even if they're 38 now, they were in their 20s then, right? And you don't necessarily think about how your life will be shaped and formed kind of forever by things you do in your 20s, right? For better or worse. And so it was really, for me, really humbling, I think, talking to them and remembering like, oh yeah, I remember you saying this, you know, even me being on the platform at that time. And or I remember that happening and you being the person that did that is wild. So I specifically like April Koo, who I know now as a friend, but just to be like, man, she just said this thing kind of in jest. And then it sparked a whole change, right? Is just really revolutionary.
It's fascinating too, because it's like you're recording history as soon as it happened too, so people are still able to reflect on it but have enough hindsight about what happened. I don't know, it just seems like culture is just moving so quickly, so that's like on every front, I guess. From your perspective, where do you think Black Twitter as a community, you know, is going next? Because I saw a lot of hype around Spill, and I'm not sure like that is actually it. And I've seen like folks try out Blue Sky and Mastodon, but I also don't think those communities are nearly as welcoming or as open as Twitter was, you know, in its heyday. What is next for the community that was Black Twitter?
I think like Kamau says this later, I think in one of the other episodes, he talks about, you know, there'll always be like some versions of the way Spill or these other things are, the way that like Net Noir and Black Planet were. But Black people like having multiple conversations. We like having our own conversations, then we also like being in the mainstream of stuff because we participate in the mainstream of stuff. So I like to say that, like, I feel like Black Twitter right now is almost like an adjective, whereas like I equate it to like in the way you think about like looking up something on the internet, no matter what search engine you use, it's called Googling. Like you say, I'm Googling it. Even if you're not on Google, you're like, I'm Googling it, right? And I feel like Black Twitter, I feel like, is like Neo in the end of the Matrix when he learns to fly, when he's like, oh, I'm no longer attached in the same way, right? Like the rules don't apply. So I feel like Black Twitter's energy has like left the platform, right? I feel like Black Twitter's energy is anything that's holding, you know, institutions and society accountable for their actions. And that's whether it's happening on TikTok, Spill, Blue Sky, Twitter, is just happening in the world now, right? Like the attitude of Black Twitter, I think, is just in the real world. Like, oh, we're not taking that. Or if we're, or that's happening, I'm calling that bullshit out, right? Like, I think like the energy is bigger than saying it's on a platform. So yes, it's called Black Twitter, but I like to think that that energy has left the building and it's just out there now.
More a vibe, more an attitude than a specific thing now, I guess. I think what was fascinating about Twitter too is like I was an early user like 2007, 2008, and like I do a movie podcast. So because of Twitter, I was able to bring in directors and bring in guests and film critics and things like that. I don't know if we'll ever have that like that sort of like level playing field again, because now it seems like social networks are siphoning off into smaller communities, right? So like Mastodon is a lot of like techies and people who like open source technology. Blue Sky has a lot of the weird vibe of early Twitter, but not quite. It's a little bit different. And then Facebook is trying to copy everything with Threads. So, Yeah, I don't know. I feel like Twitter was just a special space that we had for a while, and I'm going to miss it personally. Yeah,
it was. And I think it's interesting when you said it's kind of getting smaller. I feel the same way. I feel like the early days of Black Twitter, when it was like, I'm HBCU Twitter, this is NBA Twitter, everybody was kind of siloed off, and then we started to find ourselves. I feel like because of all the chaos that had happened, everyone's like kind of retreating back into like, what are the communities that make me feel safe again? What are the communities that make me feel heard again? And it's actually gotten away from this sort of like big town square. It has kind of gotten, and again, for better or for worse, because sometimes being in your own echo chamber of certain kind of thought is dangerous, right?
Yeah.
And so, but I do feel like people have gone back to their corners respectively, you know, digitally and certainly social media wise. I would agree with you that I'm seeing more of a retreatment back to that than I am what's participating in the mainstream? Because like the mainstream just seems a little too crazy right now, like in that way, or just too chaotic. It's just a lot of chaos, I feel like, right now.
Yeah, I just feel like, yeah, that disillusion of like that wonderful space we all had to like just be ourselves, I guess, and communicate with each other in a flat way is gone. And that's why I'm mad at Elon Musk personally. But final question for you, Prentice. You know, we like to ask this on the Engadget podcast, and clearly you are a connected person, like you're always on tech and stuff. So what are the devices, what are the gadgets and technology that you personally rely on to help you live your day to day?
Ooh, when? I'm super simple. My day to day is really still an iPad. Like most of my stuff that I do is like, whether I'm on Zooms or reading scripts, you know, like annotating work, like watching, you know, this film or that thing is literally still all an iPad. I wish it was like a fancier, I use the pen now more, I would say, the Apple Pencil pen, whatever. I'm much more in tune with that. But that's still really where I do most, I would say I do 80% of my stuff on an iPad. Mm-hmm.
Well, that's interesting to hear, too, because when we talk about the iPad and tablets, like in a way, that is the perfect computer, right? Like it is just the screen and you do all the stuff on it. And you don't have to worry about like dealing with command lines or dealing with the mess of a desktop or a laptop or something. So that's cool to hear. I'm glad like you can make that your primary device. And I'm just always fascinated to see how people actually work. Cool, Prentice. Anything else you want to mention about what you're working on? What's next for you?
No, I'm just super excited for people to see the doc. It comes out May 9th on Hulu, and I'm just super excited for people to see it.
Excellent. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.